6/6/88, recording with Ted Stockton, South Case Hall.
Ability to listen, ability to give and receive love, the ability to get along with others, and the ability to maintain lasting relationships. Those are probably the four most important things the students learn in college today. If that's probably the unspoken goal that is growing up in college, those four areas. And if someone believes that he or she doesn't need improvement in those areas, then he's at the wrong place at a residential college.
But aren't you bringing to college a lot of those qualities? I mean, how can you learn that in college? I mean, if you haven't acquired in your first 18 years of life an ability to relate to other people, certainly you're not going to learn it academically. Where are you going to learn it? Relating to your roommate?
For the first time in college, students are away from their parents. They're not forced to listen. There are no attendance policies like high schools impose. There are no curfews. There's no corner of the high school where people gossip about who's dating whom. You're not forced to talk to anybody. You don't have to sit next to anybody else in class. There are no seating charts. The freedom to practice these areas, really, the freedom comes about in college. And this is a time to develop those skills. And though you may be talented in one or more of those, college is truly the time to develop. I would guess that most happily married couples met in college, though I have nothing to back that up.
From the way you respond, though, you're assuming that most people have not had a great deal of freedom at the high school level. Is that right?
Whether you like it or not, whether a young person likes it or not, he hasn't had a lot of freedom. He or she hasn't had a lot of freedom in high school. I thought I had a lot of freedom because my parents never forced me to study. They never restricted where I worked. They allowed me to work as a valet at a nightclub in a sleazy area of Detroit.
Did you study hard in high school?
No, I didn't study at all in high school.
And you still got good grades?
I did reasonably, close to a 3-point.
Can I assume from that this high school was not particularly challenging?
I did what I had to do. The term papers, what mattered. I think I chose well what needed to be done. It wasn't the hardest high school in the world.
Did you ever sit down and analyze why you weren't motivated at that particular high school?
I thought about it and I thought about it. That's a good question. I think it has to do more with my home life. I graduated with a 295 and a 33 on the ACT. And everything was a little bit too easy. The high school was kind of pushed towards the middle. Had an exceptionally high graduation rate for working class high school. But there was never anything really that challenging. I always had the feeling, I went to class and listened most of the time, but I always had the feeling that if I just looked over the last page of the chapter, that I'd do well enough on the tests. I wasn't driven to succeed, and the way colleges are set up with the ACT, which counts for half of the entrance, I knew if I did well enough that I could get in almost anywhere I wanted.
Did you ever ask why you weren't? It seems as though because there wasn't enough external pressure, you weren't performing up to your capacity, that had you been driven more by tough teachers, et cetera, you might have produced at a higher level.
I think I would have.
Do I assume from that you weren't really inner-directed at that point? You weren't the type who could go and create your own projects and pursue your own or direct your own energies towards something which might not have anything to do with school. At least you couldn't do that in a concentrated way.
That's very untrue. I read constantly in high school. I wrote all the time and entered contests. I tried to have things published. I worked on projects of my own. I was in three musical groups outside of school. I tried to write and I did arrange music. I worked with a man who arranged music professionally, and I did some of his copywriting for him.
So you were very concentrated, but certainly not in the traditional way of responding to what the teachers were trying to teach you.
Mm-hmm. I think I learned. Although I never did particularly well on tests in school, I think I learned the curriculum. I think if they gave a test of what Fordson High School in Dearborn, Michigan had to offer, what they wanted a student to learn going through their program, I think I would do well on that test. But for some reason, the busy work I always did do well on the test. It was kind of the homework, the busy work that brought me down.
Well, if you continue in this same way, it seems to me that you will be a nonconformist of types, that you will not fit into a neat corporate world, that if you continue as your interest developed in high school, you will always take the path which interests you, and that path may not have anything to do with what the corporation may be requiring of you. Is that right?
I think that's very true. And that could be something which would cost me thousands of dollars every year.
Does it bother you? Could you talk about that a little?
I spent the first few years of my life in Spartan Village. Then I lived in a small house in West Dearborn, which is kind of an affluent suburb of Detroit. And then on the other side of Dearborn, I spent maybe the last 8 years before I went to college. And it was a working class neighborhood, just mounds of immigrants. And I never had a lot of money. I drove a 78 Rabbit with 180,000 miles on it. I didn't rent a car for prom. And
was this in contrast to what most of your contemporaries were doing? I mean, did they have newer cars?
Most people had nicer cars, nicer clothes, memberships to racket clubs. People always seemed to have more money than I did. But it never really bothered me. And I don't think having less than an upper middle class for the rest of my life would bother me, less than an upper middle class status.
Did they have a tendency to sneer down on those who didn't come up to their standard, these people who were driving around in slightly newer cars, your contemporaries? Can you talk a little bit about the caste divisions within your high school?
Within my high school? My high school was almost 50% Arabic. About 75% of those Arabs were Lebanese. They were immigrants from the war, from the PLO conflict, and it's that Middle Eastern situation. About 25% of the remaining, maybe half of the remaining, 25% of the entire population of the high school was made up of other immigrants, first and second generation, traditional Catholics, Italians, Poles, some Czechoslovakians, and the rest was made up of almost a stereotypical suburban high school, white. The kids drive Mustangs, play tennis, conform, do well. We sent a lot of people to very good schools, and most of the people who went to good schools came from that 25% of the population. In my freshman year, there was a group that considered the popular group. They were elected to homecoming court. People knew their names. In mock elections, they won. And they were the people who you'd heard about from one junior high. You would hear about them in another junior high.
Ethnically, what was their breakdown?
Usually American, a few Arabs. Usually Western European.
But was there a hostility between the Western Europeans and the Arabs, or the Middle Easterners?
When I was a freshman and when I was a junior, there were minor race riots blown out of proportion by the newspapers, which heavily favored the other side of town. But there was some tension, definitely. People were definitely. I heard so many people say upon graduation, well, it's great to be rid of the Arabs. And the Arabs, I don't think it was a fair representation of the Arabs in the Middle East. They tended to be bossy and very angry people. Of course, they had lost their country. They had left in the middle of a war, seeing their house blown up or relatives. But they tended to be fight-oriented, power-oriented, and there were tensions.
How did you regard yourself within that spectrum? Were you aggressive and antagonistic towards the Western Europeans?
I was kind of an in-between, kind of known as cocky to everybody, but nobody really hated me. The Arabs didn't jump me. Well, I was jumped at a few parties, but it was just where fights were going on, where a fight would break out and I'd grab somebody, and the next thing I knew, 7 or 8 or 10 people would be on me. But the Arabs, I wasn't an enemy. Taking swings at me, yes. It was kind of shocking.
Were people pulling knives or getting really nasty, breaking bottles?
A few. There was one fight I remember. It was a party, and there was a small group of Arabs from the very poorest part of town, right by the Forge Rouge plant. And it was a party in a rented hall. What people would do was rent a hall, find a 21-year-old to buy 8 or 10 kegs, and it was in a bad neighborhood, so the police didn't care, and then pass out bulletins and publicize these parties, and 700 to 1,000 people would come. They would charge $5, $6, $7, $8 at the door, and young people with the opportunity to drink would pay these ridiculous prices and go into these parties, and the people who had the parties would make, hire a DJ, spend $200 for that, spend $200 for the hall, and $300 for beer, and end up making $500 each on the night. But one party, I remember there was a group of kids, Arabic, about younger, about 10th grade, and they all found a ride out there, and they were just waiting for a fight. And if they all stood by the wall, they didn't dance, they didn't drink, they didn't associate with anybody except themselves, and they just stood there like a pack of wolves surrounding a fight. And the moment somebody pushed somebody else, they just came out like a tidal wave. And my friend was very drunk. I usually didn't drink at parties, but my friend was very drunk. And I usually drove, so I didn't drink. And my friend was very drunk, and he kind of went into the middle and was trying to look at the action. He was kind of a ghoulish spectator. And I went in to pull him out, and the next thing I knew, I saw a little kid standing on a table. And he jumped out. He must have been reading too many Marvel comics, but he jumped out and landed with a punch on my face. And I kind of hit him back and kind of punched and pushed at the same time. I didn't want to get in a fight surrounded with people with blood in their eyes.
So you were still very much under control yourself.
And the next thing I knew, I would guess 8 to 10 people on me. And they're almost so savage. Actually, they were so savage that I was able to escape. They were so into pounding on me and so into what they were doing, their bloodthirsty look and their desire for blood, that I was able to just crawl out without their noticing.
Were you feeling very angry after that?
After that, yes. I was very angry, knowing that there was nothing I could do back.
Still, from your description of this fight, you seem to be a person very much in control. I mean, you didn't flip out. I mean, you didn't become a lunatic and pull a knife and do crazy things. I mean, you got out in a rather discreet way. I mean, you left the scene.
My best friend called me the most even-tempered person she's ever met. I don't know if that's true. Maybe it's become less true since I came to college, but...
You know, it strikes me that even though these early experiences were rocky, that you have an advantage over these freshmen here, because a lot of these kids coming from high schools haven't gone through the range of emotional experiences you have, and they're going through all of this crap in their freshman year of college. You went through it all several years ago, or a couple of years ago. Is that accurate? Do you have an advantage in terms of emotional stability over a lot of these freshmen?
The first term, I was tripled, rather, in a two-person room, in a small room with two other guys, and both of them were kind of spoiled, richer, naive, and one of them was class president of his small-town high school in Traverse City, and the other was from Okemos, and he, quite rich, had always had everything he wanted, and life was a skateboard to him, and the first one from Traverse City, Jim, he'd graduated with a very high grade point average from high school, and he had never been drunk and hadn't really dated any girls. And within the first 3 weeks, I saw him bent over the toilet 5 or 6 times. He had never been maturely introduced to alcohol. He had never had an opportunity to drink at a stable level, and he just drank himself silly and was puking his brains out and doing stupid things when he got drunk. And he also had a messed up relationship with a girl. He didn't know how to pursue her, and he went after a couple girls who had boyfriends, which I view as kind of a low thing. And he'd do things like calling their sweet mate and having their sweet mate go get the girl out of the room. If the girl was in the guy's room, call the guy's sweet mate and have him get the girl, saying it was an emergency and the boyfriend couldn't find out. And he basically made a fool out of himself and got all these awful nicknames, and nobody could stand him. And the other one, he had been dating a girl for 2 years when he came to school, and that relationship was over in 2 months. He was tense about everything, and he was jealous, and it just ruined the relationship.
How typical do you think these accounts are of other freshmen here?
Very typical. Very, very typical. I know 5 or 6 girls up here who lost their virginity when they were drunk. That's just out of my friends. It's just amazing, the number. I know people who had never drunk in high school, and now every time they drink, they throw up, they get sick, and do stupid things. I know people who have dropped from above a 3.5 in high school to 2.5, maybe even 1.5 in their first year. I think a lot of people really lose it their first year.
Are you telling me that the biggest adjustment from high school to college then is a social one?
Yes.
I mean, it's an emotional problem?
Yes.
And that in turn obviously affects the academic. Very interesting. I'm just, if you'd follow up a little bit more on the story with your roommates, did you try to help them in any way or intervene in any way, or what did you do there?
I hated my roommates.
You what?
I hated my roommates. I always kept razor blades handy for them in case they wanted to end it all. No, I didn't do that, but I considered it, and I really personally didn't care about them. They were horrible to me. They were very selfish, very spoiled. The first time I went in there, I went home for a weekend. First time I came back, all my clothes were pushed aside, and they had all the things spread out neatly with space for every little article of clothing. They had all my stuff pushed to one side of the shelf. They had moved my bed to the lounger. It's just the couch you get in the room, off one of the regular beds when I wasn't there. They made the decision to build a loft without talking to me. They were very inconsiderate. They never shared a room before.
Wasn't there any democratic approach to these problems? I mean, wasn't there any effort to sit down and say, look, let's flip a coin and see who gets which bed or which chest of drawers, etc.?
There was, and then they kind of went back on that. They're very selfish, very inconsiderate, but also very intimidated by me for one reason or another. And they were very scared of confrontations. They would do things when I wasn't there. And since I tried to be out of the room as much as I could, I just usually didn't show my anger.
Were they afraid of you because you didn't fit the WASP stereotype?
That's possible. When I first came here, I was dating a girl kind of seriously, but we had a relationship where we could see other people. And that was very foreign to them. Yeah, that's true, that I didn't fit the stereotype. That intimidated them. Everything I did seemed to be foreign. They asked me what I wanted to do, and I said, I have no idea, just take my classes, maybe go to graduate school. And that bothered them because they had these ideas in their head. I was very liberal, politically and socially, and that bothered them.
Well, were there lighter moments in all of this where you were, clearly you weren't able to relate too well to these particular roommates, but I mean, other people, suite mates or people down the hall with whom you could have some fun?
I think the most interesting person I've met here, his name is Bromlett Hamilton. He's a junior from Okemos. He's black, and the amazing thing about him is that he's very intelligent, and he can turn off his black, he can turn on his black. He can be a street person, he can be an academic person. He's here basically on a free ride, and that's because of brains. Whether he was a minority or not, he would have those scholarships. And it's just amazing that one great moment I remember, we were in his room playing chess, but we were betting on the game of chess, and he had blasting from his speakers something called house music, which is rap or street black music. And I think that was the most ironic moment I've had since I've been here. And that was a light moment. I really enjoyed him.
What was the outcome of this, though? I mean,
this juxtaposition
of this game and the music and the
and gambling on the game. We've become very good friends. That's if there's an outcome.
Well, considering your interest in offbeat types, why didn't you end up going to school at U of M or some offbeat Eastern school? Is it primarily a financial thing, or
the schools which accepted me were Oberlin, Michigan, Michigan State, and Illinois Wesleyan. I kind of made up my mind to go to Illinois Wesleyan. I thought it was like a Grinnell sort of college, very liberal. And I went there and I hated it. It was much too conservative. And half the people left there married. And that kind of bothered me. And Oberlin was just altogether too expensive. I didn't like Michigan. I didn't like Ann Arbor too well. And I like the campus here. I think you can find all types of people. And lately I'm finding more and more. My roommate now is fantastic. I'm pretty happy with the choice. I thought I would be around more people like myself at Michigan State.
More people who do not conform. By conformist, I mean your definition of a conformist might be somebody who fit more the mold of your roommates. The people who had everything mapped out, who were going from point A to point C in a very methodical way, who are unwilling to explore in the ways that you wish to explore, and who don't really fraternize with people who are very much unlike themselves.
I think the people I like, if I could define it in a few words or in one phrase, people who really understand that there is a time for everything and know when that time is. Those are the people I like best. People who know, although I'm not a drunk, I don't party like crazy, I know there's a time to get drunk, and I do that. Although I'm not a study hound, I know there's a time to study, and when I need to study, I sit down and do it. And I like people who do the same and have the same views of when that time is.
Well, I feel that I'm talking to a maverick of sorts, and I can't see you fitting into the straight and narrow corporate world. And I don't know how much you've thought about this, but how do you see yourself fitting into the gross commercial world after school, or what?
Just since I've come here, if I had to bet on one thing I'd end up doing, I would be a college professor. That's really the only thing I can see myself doing, where learning is independent. Teaching, college professors have so much freedom, and that's beautiful. I'm sure I could make money if I went to law school or worked my tail off and then got an MBA and went to some nice Eastern or Ivy League graduate school. I could make a lot of money, but I really don't believe I'd be happy. I wouldn't like the pressure. To be perfectly honest, I don't think I'd like the people in those fields. And I like college professors a lot. The ones I've met here are great to talk to.
Ever talk to them about the ingrown qualities of the world of academia? The stultifying effect of going to an endless number of administration meetings with the administration, trying to survive within your department, and the petty rivalries and jealousies that exist at that level. I mean, it is absolutely endless.
My father is the chairman of his department.
I shouldn't have even asked the question. And lecture me on the subject.
I could list so many names. That would be very unethical.
No, I'm
but,
not asking.
Yeah, that. I could list so many incidents. There's a woman there. She was brought in by affirmative action. They had to hire an economist, and nobody wants to give up their economists. They pay their economists extra because they assumed that they could make more anywhere else, and he had to hire an economist. And there was one, and her university made her available, and it had to be a woman. And this was the only female economist they found in the Midwest, and the condition was that she was brought in under tenure. And they brought her in, tenured, and she has not published one article in 9 years, yet she is tenured. And she gets extra raises because she's an economist, and the dean deems that so, that economists need more money or they'll go get a job with GM. And I personally feel, why don't they, if they could make so much more money? And the first year my father was chairman, he wrote her a note saying, so-and-so, you are a valued colleague. Keep up the good work. And the next year, he wrote her a note, a note which at the end of the year a chairperson writes to his staff or to the people in his department. Second year, his note said, so-and-so, you're a talented professor. Hopefully, your ideas seem to be excellent. Hopefully, we'd be able to see something in writing. And within a few weeks, there was a sex discrimination suit against my father. And this woman was claiming that there was no way she could work there because my father hated her because she was a woman and didn't respect her. And she couldn't, the reason she wasn't publishing was because she was so upset all the time that even her department chairman couldn't respect her because of her sex.
Very interesting. All right. This is one of many stories, I'm sure, that you've heard from your father about the bullshit that goes on in the academic world. But you tell me that you might be interested in living in this world. There seems to be a possible contradiction here.
Well, there are maybe two things you can do with freedom. You can be a writer, and you can be a college professor. And I don't like the business world. I suppose owning your own business would give you some freedom, but I certainly don't like that, and I wouldn't want to do that. I value teaching a lot. I value education a lot. And I think, as a college professor, one could write and read and teach. And what you have to put up with, it would be annoying, but you just kind of have to laugh it off. Just assume that everybody else in the world is a robot performing for you, and you should just that you're the only living person in the world, and everybody else is just a robot put on Earth by some supreme being to entertain you. And if you look at it that way, you should handle the insane people in your department.
Well, do you have an inclination to write on a personal level? Or are we talking about writing within a particular field, or writing in the quote creative way, as short stories, etc.?
There always seems to be a pen in my hand when I'm not doing anything else. I keep a journal. I have for the last several years. I love to write stories. I love to start stories. I love to write about one scene. If I think of a good way to phrase something, I'd love to write a scene revolving, just building up from that one phrase. Or if I think of a clever way to word something, I could see writing a scenario where I could use that wording. I love expository writing, narrative, just any sort of writing I could see myself doing.
Have you tried to get anything published?
I have had a few things published in young literary journals, and they weren't too reputable. It wasn't stuff I was especially proud of, but it was clever, kind of cute. I think I will eventually.
Frankly, I don't know how a lot of kids sort out what they're going to do. They arrive here, and they look at the catalog, and there are 1,400 different courses, and even though they have to take a lot of 100-level courses, still they have to have some sense of direction. Can you talk a little bit about the process you went through as you... Why are you going in the direction that you are? Why have you dismissed the sciences, for example?
I haven't fully dismissed the sciences yet. I had an awful experience with trigonometry in high school. And I just had an awful teacher, and we fought. And I didn't really want to take math again. But the more I read about what upper-level math courses are like, the more I want to take those. Because I think once the theory of matrices, that sort of math class, it's all philosophy. And that interests me. That figuring out the area under a bridge interests me. Actually, on the SAT and the ACT, I did better on the math and science parts than I did on the others, which is interesting. I haven't written them off, but right now, I think this is more important to me. This is what I'm more interested in. When I came here deciding on classes, I'm in James Madison College, so I was required to take two classes in the college. And then I always wanted to take French, so I took the French class that seemed appropriate. It was a composition class. And there was a counselor there suggesting to people with certain scores on certain tests that they should take this honors philosophy class. And what I found out was that they were just trying to peddle this class to people who didn't know better, because the teacher was so awful that anybody who had been at the university wouldn't take his class. So in my first term, that's how I decided on my classes. And then winter term was a sad story, because I went through early registration. I was very enthusiastic about the courses I had chosen. And I went through registration, picked my classes, and handed in my cards, and got back to my room and realized that there was an important card that I hadn't handed in, and my classes weren't processed. So I took three courses that maybe the three only courses open at drops and ads. And spring term, I took the two James Madison courses again, and I took French again. And then I took a music class, which I've always been interested in. And I heard that Michigan State had one of the best criminal justice departments in the country. And I thought it would be a shame to go through the college, to go through Michigan State without taking a criminal justice class, so I took one of those. Other people, time is an unfortunate factor in deciding schedules for many students. They don't want to take a 3 o'clock class. They don't want to take a 9:10 class. They try to push everything around lunchtime, or some of them want night classes. So sometimes people would just decide not to take a class they really wanted.
All right, so you know that you're talented or potentially capable of doing a lot of things. You can do something in the sciences if you want, and you can certainly do something in the humanities. Now, do you have any kind of a drive to excel in one field? I mean, if 10 years from now, do you want to be able to look back and say, this is the continuity that defined my life in college. I finally ended up majoring in this, and from there I went to point B, to point C, to point D, and this is what I've, quote, produced. Does that matter to you, to be able to say that? Do you want to see a continuity of that kind in your life?
No.
Can you talk a little bit about your philosophy there?
One of the most important things I've learned this year, or at least realized, it's really something you can judge a person on. Not judge them how good or bad this person is, but how well you can get along. Ambiguity in a person's life. And one thing I've found is that I'm an extremely ambiguous person. And others, sometimes ambiguous people compensate for others who aren't. And as far as choosing one thing, that's very difficult for me. Whereas for other people, it would be difficult not to choose just one thing. I knew a girl who used to go crazy. She would just get all flustered and say, I can't decide what I want to be. I can't decide what to major in. And I know other people who need to know what they're going to be doing. These people tended to do better in high school because they did well in a scenario with canned learning. You go to class every day and you get homework assignments and you read 40 pages and you take a multiple choice test. Whereas ambiguous people tend to do better in college. Not necessarily better than the less ambiguous people, but better than they did in high school, or adapt better. And that's...
But don't you think morality is sometimes defined as producing something within a given field? I mean, people talk about the career that you must have, and that you must make a certain level of progress from year to year within that career. And if you don't do that, sometimes you're regarded as spread too thin. You're immoral in some way. And don't you feel that? I mean, you can't be ambiguous forever and feel good about it. Eventually you must choose, correct?
I think that you can make lifelong choices and still remain ambiguous. I'll probably get married someday. I'll probably have kids. As far as remaining ambiguous, I'll probably pick one field or another. I don't think I'll be jumping back and forth between writing and engineering. I think maybe a goal is kind of a broader goal. Maybe making the world a better place after I left. That sounds kind of idealistic, but I'm an idealistic person. Bringing up a son or a daughter who knows more than I do. Something which sounds just wonderful to me is raising a kid, and then when the kid is 16 years old and he wants to do something, or he tells me something and I tell him he's wrong or he can't, and then he tells me that I'm full of shit and he's right, that just sounds fantastic to me. Then I'll know that I've succeeded in whatever goal I do have. That would really satisfy me if that kind of thing happened. I guess teaching is not just teaching in a classroom, but teaching, talking to other people, and having both of us develop. If that's a goal, if I had to name one goal, that would be it.
Well, so you have a touch of idealism in you. I mean, how would you compare yourself? I'm sure you're aware of the attitude of many of the students of the 1960s who were protesting and who wanted to right the world, etc. Compare yourself to that group in terms of your idealism and their general energy level and idealism.
I would fit in better in the 1960s than I do now. I wasn't there. I haven't read much literature from that time. I haven't learned much from my parents because they're from small towns, which were very conservative. And my father was never in a protest, never involved in protests, because he had two young kids to feed. And they and a wife to support, and he was out of the country for much of that time. But from what I know, I really think there is a group of people who are from the 60s. They live in a co-op house. It's called the Monty House. And just among those people, although it's for geographical reasons and just logistical reasons, I couldn't live there because it's too far from everywhere I have to go. But just among those people, I feel very at home. They all seem to be driven, carefree about some things, but intense in their beliefs about others.
What's the house, the photograph we saw in the paper? Mm-hmm.
If that's what the 60s were like, if the 60s were like people are there, then I would have fit in better in the 1960s. Hearing many of the things that they protested for and that they fought for and against, they make me angry, the things they fought against, or it makes me proud that a generation accomplished that. Civil rights, protesting Vietnam, those things still really eat me up that we were in Vietnam and our role there. And I saw Westmoreland and I felt just like the 30-year-olds who knew the man like their next door neighbor. And when I read about the civil rights cases, I just get furious. I get tense. I can't believe that one human being could do that to another. And as far as that goes, I think I would have fit in better in the 1960s.
Well, so your mentality obviously goes far beyond the mentality of some of the students here, who are focusing on graduating, getting a job, and having a family, and they don't think about meeting any kind of responsibility to the society. At least that's been my reaction. And can you give me a quick appraisal of where the mindset is for a lot of these kids in terms of their goals?
I think it's good that you put them in a bunch because they're pretty much interchangeable. They're very frustrating. A friend of mine came up with a good description of them. She called them PCCRs, and they're pig-headed, chauvinistic, conservative Republicans. And that it was just so perfect. Any one of them, there's really no point in arguing with two or three, or arguing with one day and one the next, because they're all going to say exactly the same thing. All of them are incredibly conservative. They want to make a lot of money. They all go to James Madison College for undergraduate, go to Michigan Law, Harvard Law, University of Chicago Law. They all think they're going to do this, then have a kid and live in Farmington Hills with their kids going to public school or to private schools, and they would never vote for a tax hike, and the beggars on the streets of Detroit drive away in Lincoln Continentals from the money they make that day. They are so stereotypical. They think they're independent, they think they're free, but they're the most confined people I've ever met.
Would you describe that as the majority in James Madison?
They're the most visible. Two of them affect me like 200 of them. So to me, they seem like a majority. I shouldn't let them, but they bother me. They get to me like crazy. It would be tough to say they are the most visible. They do shoot off their mouths the most in class, giving arguments which I'm sure the teachers have heard so many times before, at least for the last 5 years since this group of people came about.
How do you explain that? I mean, where did these people, why did they so totally lack the desire to explore and seek out alternatives that perhaps their parents even had, or maybe their parents didn't have that? I mean, aren't these the kids of the people who grew up in the 60s to some extent?
Maybe the parents from the 1960s were tired. They were tired of fighting. Maybe they thought it was hopeless. Maybe they gave up. My parents went to school with, went to graduate school with, who had lived in Spartan Village, and when they saw somebody out with a barbecue would throw on their steaks. Many of those people they see now have conformed so much, and it makes my parents sad. They say, well, so-and-so would have never voted against this tax hike. He never would have sent his kid to a private school, and now look at him. Several people that my father went to school with are now working for the CIA, and they were just as active as everybody else, protesting what the CIA did when they were 18, 19, 20, 25. Maybe the parents got tired, and they're tired of being poor. And plus, these kids were brought up in They had a lot of money as kids. They had a lot of things, and things seemed important.
Well, it's like the some of the members of the Chicago Seven. They're selling insurance and working for banks now. Abby Hoffman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Some of those types settle down into very stable upper middle class existences.
Uh-huh.
All right. I'm going to give you a transcript of this. It'll probably take me a couple of weeks to. You're going to be around here another 2 or 3 years, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you like it well enough, in spite of the.
PCCRs.
Yeah, the PCCRs. There are enough of the other types. You haven't figured out a series of initials for them yet. But in any case, you'll stick around.
I'll be here.
Yeah. Anyway, I'll give you a transcript, and hopefully you won't throw it in the fireplace. In 10 years, you'll haul it out and look at it, and you can say, or can read it and say, I did say those things. Unbelievable or whatever. With that in mind, is there anything you'd like to say about your dreams, your hopes, your direction, or anything at all that you would like to hear 10 years down the pike? That you'd like to pick up and look at and say, here's something that I said. For better or worse, I did say it.
I'd never like to forget what I was saying today. I'd always like it to be true. I never want to give in. I never want to give in to money. I never want to give in to the easy way out. I never want to give in to that opportunity. If an MBA doesn't make me happy, I never want to get an MBA. If I don't like what lawyers do, I don't want to be a lawyer. I never want to use the same packet of, if I'm a college professor, I never want to use the same packet of materials twice in a row unless I've looked and couldn't find anything better. I never want to give my kids anything they want, everything they want. Maybe I'd love to give them everything they need, but I'd never want to give them anything they want. And if I get married and have children and they want to protest, I'd like to give them enough values that they'd have something to protest against.
Is that it?
That's it.
That's great. If you can stick to that, you'll go a long way, believe me. Well, that's the end of the interview.